from the House Committee on Judiciary. Today is Tuesday, March 3rd. The first item is a public hearing and possible work session. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2453. Mr. Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2453 comes to you from Representative Barton, and it extends the attorney-client privilege to include an agent of the client.
I represent Barton.
You have the dash two amendments in front of you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee.
I have a dash one and a dash two.
The difference, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, between the dash one and the dash two, I actually had to call Legislative Counsel's office for this one. And on line five, it says or in the dash two, and line five on one, it says and.
Oh, and we're supposed to, it's supposed to be two.
I believe that the two supersede the dash one. Is that correct?
That's correct. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Brent Barton. I'm a state representative in House District 51. In front of you is the dash two versus the dash one. You remember yesterday we had some problems with conjunctive, and that came back from LC. Dash two is, says or, and dash one is and. So let me give you the background about this bill, explain what the problem is, and what it is we are trying to fix. Indeed, it is a very, very narrow quirk that is unique to Oregon law, and I think is not very well known. I actually encountered this originally in my law practice. And so the dash two amendments in front of you essentially model the Oregon Evidence Code on what is the Uniform Evidence Code. It's commonly adopted throughout most American jurisdictions. The Uniform Evidence Code was promulgated, in, I believe, in 1976, sometime in the mid to late 70s, and it was rapidly adopted in just about every American jurisdiction, including the Federal Rules of Evidence. Each one has its little quirks, but it's largely based on this code. At the time, there was a question about what is the representative of a client, and let me tell you when this becomes relevant. It becomes relevant when a corporation is seeking legal counsel. So let's use me as an example. I practice law at Perkins Coie. We represent many corporations. And let's pretend we represent, say, a large company, say Adidas. I just throw this out here randomly. The question is who is it within Adidas, when they talk to Adidas' counsel, Perkins Coie, when is that a privileged communication or when is it not? And it's only, and that's where the definition in front of you, representative of client, becomes relevant. It's only privileged when it's a representative of the client being the corporation. So when the definition of representative client, there were two tests for this in the late 70s after the Uniform Evidence Code was promulgated. There was the majority rule and the minority rule. And the minority rule was called the control group test. And it was the narrower of the two, and Oregon followed that. And Oregon was unique, and why we have this today is Oregon was unique in that Oregon actually codified its approach. In the early 80s, if anyone's interested, I can get you the actual case. The U.S. Supreme Court rejected the minority, the control group test, in favor of the majority group test, and the control group test disappeared from American law. The only problem is Oregon actually was left with this now defunct test in statute. And so we changed it. Mm-hmm. I believe, I want to say in 1986, this is going from the top of my head, and we changed it to what is still current law. The problem is that there are a couple quirks, and in that it is, in no cases technically in Oregon law is an independent contractor of the of a corporation able to have a privileged communication with that corporation's counsel. And that certainly there are many instances when that is absolutely necessary for legal advice. And you can see my original bill, the unamended version, was trying to essentially expand to include agents in to fix this problem. I since became aware that that created more problems than it solved. Agent is a very broad term. And so I've worked with several groups, including members of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association and Robert Neuberger in particular, to try and different approaches, and ultimately we determined that the best approach was what is reflected in the dash two, and that is essentially to follow the Uniform Evidence Code. And essentially the approach in the dash two amendments is currently the law in the vast majority, if not just about every other American jurisdiction. That said, Mr. Chair, does anyone have any questions?
How would this affect a criminal case?
So first of all, I don't think the The current statute does not distinguish the attorney-client privilege between criminal and civil matters, such that, let me think of an unusual but plausible case in which, say, individual agents within a corporation or employees are involved in criminal matters, or that there is a criminal matter would be brought directly against a corporation and also against employees, in which case I could see how some issues might emerge.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Barton, why your section 2, you're saying that this effect applies to communication before we do the bill. Is that going to be a problem? Is that going to put burden on the courts or the legal
Mr. Chair, system? Representative Wisnett, I don't think so. And the reason why is it is not well known that this quirk exists in Oregon law. I think most people, most lawyers, when talking with their counsel, operate as though that their communications with certain independent contractors are indeed privileged. And frankly, I think that this bill is actually bringing Oregon law to reflect what most people already think it is. And actually, an example that occurs to me, the contract lobby here. Let's pretend you have a corporation, say Corporation A, and they hire a law firm. And they also hire a lobbyist, and that there's some kind of political question. Actually, currently under Oregon law, the communications between that lobbyist, which is an independent contractor, and the counsel of the corporation are not privileged. Frankly, I think if most of the contract lobby in this building knew that, there would be quite a bit of support for this bill today.
Representative Garrett,
for opposition.
For you to decide.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm not sure that I want to go in the direction of providing more veil of secrecy for corporations in dealing with their contractors. So let me make sure I understand this, particularly when you're talking about CPAs or a variety of professional services that a corporation might get provided to it. Would this bill require that those be privileged communications between, let's say, the CPA is talking to the general counsel is talking to the law firm? Would that add a level of attorney-client privilege to any discussions with the CPA, which my understanding is wouldn't apply now?
Mr. Speaker, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, I see. It would only apply if one of the two criteria in the Dash 2 amendments are met, such as if it were somehow necessary, I think, for the representation. It would not create a blanket privilege, as actually the unamended version would, and that was not my intention. And actually, I think your same question, frankly, concerns for that, why, for example, the plaintiff's bar was initially very resistant to my original bill as drafted, and why I worked with them to try and accommodate those concerns.
Follow up?
Please.
So let me make sure I understand the Dash 2. So is the issue you're trying to get at here that it would narrow it to only independent contractors who are associated with providing legal services, outside legal services to the corporation, so it wouldn't apply to the CPA?
Mr. Speaker, second time now, Mr. Chair, Representative Shields, it would, I believe, and frankly I don't even have the Dash 2s in front of me, but I believe it would, going from memory, that would only apply to the independent contractors such as CPA were it necessary for the council to provide the client legal services. In the original unamended version, it would create too expansive of a privilege. It would go to all agents. Mm-hmm. And the problem with that approach, and why the reason why we have opted with the Dash 2s, is because that would be both over and under inclusive. Clearly, there are some agents for whom attorney-client privilege is not necessary and is indeed unwarranted. However, I believe with the Dash 2s, if the CPA, for example, had the authority to hire a lawyer or make legal decisions on behalf of the client, in which case then it would be also necessary for the CPA to be able to have privileged communications with the counsel. Only in that kind of circumstance would the privilege attach.
Thank you. Representative Martin, it appears to me that I'm trying to crosswalk it against the existing law and the dash twos, and it appears to me that in reality what we've done to some extent is tighten up that privilege vis-a-vis the representative of the client. And, I mean, we not only cleaned up the language, but it looks like it swept through the existing language and really did tighten it up and focus it on. It looks to me a narrower class of people. Am I mistaken? Or
Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, I don't necessarily know that it's a narrower class.
But I
don't think it's certainly not a substantial broadening of the class. This is, I think, we're actually talking about a very discrete circumstance. Also, I think you brought up something, sort of one of the significant benefits of this. I believe it will substantially improve and clarify the jurisprudence in Oregon courts surrounding what is called, I believe, Rule 502, based on the Uniform Evidence Code. That's what it refers to. It's currently a little disturbed because Oregon has a unique statute because of its unique history. Oregon courts, when interpreting this, can't look to other jurisdictions, which is kind of defeats the purpose of a uniform code. And this, because it essentially mirrors explicitly the Uniform Evidence Code, I think will allow Oregon courts to basically incorporate a very well and cleanly defined case law.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
When I said narrow, the construct of the dash two, it appears to me that in the existing statute, it has representative of the client, and then in that initial line, it has a laundry list of folks, and it appears to me that we've tightened that up considerably, and included in that was an employee, just an employee, not an employee. And my reading of the dash twos is that there's got to be a nexus between the employee and the purpose of that employment. It has to relate directly to either the authority to obtain professional legal services or one that's effectuating the legal representation. So when I said narrowed, that's more of what I was saying, is the way the construct of the statute now reads with a dash twos, it's cleaner and I think a little clearer and narrows down, I think, the pool of people who might have come under this.
Mr. Chair, Representative Stigler, I understand. I agree.
Representative Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's great seeing you in that seat. and thanks for bringing the bill forward.
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, I assure you it's great seeing you.
To the extent we know, and I understand that some of the challenges are confusion, mm-hmm. but how is this litigated now, right? Like how to the extent you can give a snapshot of how is this dealt with now, and related and second question, is your bill best viewed as a codification of current case law or at least current common practice?
Chair, Representative Smith, two questions there. Let me address the second one first, just because I remember it. I believe, and this is my own personal opinion, that this bill, dash two, reflects a codification of what is current practice and widely accepted in Oregon, not necessarily case law, actually. Can you remind me of your first question, please?
Yeah, to the extent that we have had opinions on this question, has anybody spoken to it or, talked about the scope of privilege in case law, given that we don't have a clear codification in statute?
Mr. Chair, Representative Smith, there is some Oregon case law. It's fairly sparse. I believe there are, I want to say, a handful. I could count them on one hand, I believe, in the number of cases that have addressed this specifically. And unsurprisingly, it's somewhat confused just because Oregon, again, has this unique posture. And I do believe that the Dash 2 amendments will actually clarify it by bringing in line and actually increase predictability in representation, both in terms from the client's perspective as well as the counsel's perspective.
It might be valuable at some point to see, And if there's a bunch of big hassle, we can set it aside. But if it's not a big hassle, we have a couple of those cases just to get a sense of either what the range of confusion is or what the mild consensus might be. But otherwise, I'm done, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Garrett.
Sorry, I guess I think I'm going to repeat yourself. But the dash twos will or will not cover independent contractors?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, the dash twos, As I read, will cover some independent contractors, not all, and it will cover those independent contractors who essentially fall under Section B or C of the Dash 2 amendments, i.e., in some cases, let's pretend it's a very small company. Let me give you a couple hypotheticals where certain political, let's pretend, to use the lobby sense, because I happen to know, Representative Garrett, that you do some political law work. Let's pretend you had a client that was a small political shop, but essentially their political strategy was formulated by their contract lobbyist, who was maybe was also working on a pro bono basis. In which case, in order for you to represent that client on a in an effective way on a political law question, you would have to confer with their contract lobbyist. You'd have, because the contract lobbyist is responsible for formulating political strategy. And in some cases, the political strategy might intersect entirely with the legal strategy in a political law case. That's the kind of independent contractor who would fall under sections B or C.
Well, the reason for my question is the phrase scope of the person's employment on line 8. Is that a phrase that reaches independent contractors? Maybe under the law it is, but an independent contractor is not an employment relationship. Mm-hmm. And so by saying scope of employment, are we defining independent contractors out of this statute?
I see what you're saying. Mr. Chair, Representative Garrett, I see what you're saying. And candidly, it's an interesting question. I don't know, but I'm willing to guess. But being this follows verbatim the Uniform Evidence Code, I believe. Accordingly, I mean, that's been around for over 30 years now. I'm sure that that's settled law. I just cannot. It's clearly, I happen to know that it does not exclude explicitly independent contractors, which is indeed one of the purposes for bringing this bill forward. To the extent that's produced litigation, it wouldn't surprise me in the least, but I suspect that's been resolved.
Okay. I'm good. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
I do have a question.
Oh, wait a minute. Mr. Taylor.
Chairman of the Committee, Representative Barton, the second phrase, the way I read this is B seems to apply to independent contractors, and I tend to go along with Representative Garrett. The term employment does raise concern in my mind, particularly when you look at current law when it refers to employee and that does not refer to independent contractor. But when I'm looking at we've got a person who has authority to obtain professional legal services on behalf of a client. I understand that. Or to act in legal advice rendered to the client. What is the difference between the two? And I'm trying to figure out who would a person be that acts on behalf of legal advice.
Mr. Chair, Counsel, let me give an example from my own practice, which is actually what brought me, what gave me this idea, and Representative Garrett's, this is a case that I worked on with Peggy Crane. It is, and I without giving divulging too many details, because I think this case is settled, but in one case, for example, that we were representing a client, and client is industrial client, and is very good at its manufacturing. However, is not necessarily the most sophisticated in certain, for example, acquisitions. Accordingly, they hired an independent contractor, basically a consultant, to come in and manage this deal for them, a significant real estate acquisition. They did not, thus every aspect of the deal, the acquisition of it, was done by the consultant. They were given that authority to do so by the client. Then later on, this real estate deal fell apart and produced some very significant litigation, in the multi-million dollar range. Now, in that case, in my firm, Perkins Coie, was brought in. In that case, clearly, the consultant was still very much managing the project, and even though the underlying client was the one who retained Perkins Coie, the consultant would be the one who actually was acting on the legal advice and making the relevant decisions.
Right.
Counsel, it looks like I didn't clarify that for you at all.
Chairman, as a clerk, Representative Barton, then I assume that person was authorized to obtain legal advice.
No, it says legal services. It says obtain legal services.
Mr. Chair and Counsel,
and there may be a difference.
I believe I see a distinction, and clearly I'm not clarifying that, but I do believe there's a distinction, and But I albeit a narrow one.
Hey, Representative Steger, we have some other people
who
are going to be testifying.
Yeah, no, I was just going to say, I think there's enough of a distinction between somebody who's given authority to obtain legal services and one that is designated to act on that person, on the legal representative's advice. So, I mean, it could be very different people within the scheme of things, so I know.
Mr. Chair, I haven't felt this way since I carried my first bill on the House floor.
We're all sponsors.
All right. Yeah, I was going to say, good Lord, no captain.
But the afternoon's young.
Okay. Yes.
The worst day of your life so far. Thank you. Anybody else have anything else? Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Bennett, Mr. Uegler, and Gail Meyer, please.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Richard Uegler, and I'm a partner at Landy Bennett Blumstein. I'm going to ask my partner, David Bennett, to make initial remarks, and I'm going to try to fill in some gaps, give you a little background about my practice and why I'm here to speak in support of the bill. But I thought I'd have a well-known, accomplished business lawyer from the business community first talk about a purpose and why it's important to change the existing language in the attorney-client privilege.
And Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the only reason Rick spoke first...
Could you identify yourself for the record, please?
I'm sorry, David Bennett.
Thank you.
I'm a lawyer in Portland, the firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein. I didn't speak first because I was handing something to the clerk, and Mr. Uegler preempted me, so it's one of the things that happens with partners, I guess. Our office, I've been practicing law for some 38 years, primarily a real estate lawyer, represent a lot of developers, and in recent years, the last 25 or 30 years, have been representing a lot of owners associations for the types of projects that we created. One of the issues that arises with respect to owners associations is that they necessarily are managed, larger ones and even some smaller ones, by a management agent. So when we are rendering legal service to that association, or indeed being requested to render legal services, we are requested by the management agent. And sometimes we'll talk to the chair or litigation committee, but more frequently we're talking to the management agent. So we're very concerned that the communications that we give, the advice that we give, advice that might be effectuated by that managing agent or employees of the management agent are privileged. Certainly on the other side, if there is an opposing party, we are not privy to the communications between that opposing party and counsel for the opposing party. And in a situation where we're dealing through a management agent, if that's not privileged, then we're not on the same level playing ground as our opposing counsel. So there can be cases of assessment collection, rules enforcement, there could be outside parties, construction defect litigation, and the like, all of which we're involved in. And so we see that this is a very important distinction. I'm not a trial lawyer, but when I screw something up, I turn to Rick, and he has to try to figure out how to handle matters where I might have disclosed something that I felt was privileged and giving legal advice, and it turns out it might not have been. We haven't had a lot of issues and a lot of problems in the past, but there have been demands, and we foresee that there could be in the future, and consequently we support this bill. That the communications we make with persons who are not the client but who are requesting the legal advice, and persons who are not the client but are effectuating the legal advice that we give, be privileged. I think those are the two distinctions between B and C. One, a person who is requesting the advice, authorized to request legal advice under B and C, I believe that's a person who is effectuating the legal advice, even though it might not have been the person who requested it. So if you have questions of me, I'd be happy to answer it, or I'll have Rick, who is the immediate past president of the State Bar and president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association several years ago. And I didn't do very well in evidence in law school 40 years ago, so I'll let him talk as to the evidence.
Do you think any questions?
Thank you. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I'm Rick Uegler. I'm past president of the Oregon Trial Lawyers, and last year I had the privilege to be president of the Oregon State Bar. I'm not speaking on behalf of either of those organizations here today, but I'm here as a practicing lawyer who does both plaintiff and defense work in the civil context. We represent businesses, and we also represent individuals. I continue to have a very vibrant personal injury practice as a plaintiff's lawyer, securities lawyer, and I also do plenty of defense work representing businesses. This issue came up just coincidentally with my partners who are in the transaction area. They came back from a conference of community associations where this very issue was a topic of discussion and came into my office to ask whether or not the day-to-day communications we have with managing agents of community associations would be privileged. At that time, I pointed them to the existing language of the rule, which only protects as privileged communications that occur with A, principal, B, employee, C, officer, D, director of a client who is there for acquiring legal information, etc. So those are principals, no problem with that. Officers and directors, very standard for corporations that those are people within the classic control group test, and the word employee. Well, community associations who are really managed on a day-to-day basis through management associations, they're not employees. They are truly independent contractors. But that is their role, to facilitate the receipt of legal advice and to act on legal advice for those associations. And we've had to do some gymnastics over the years to protect those communications. Fortunately, the legislative commentary to the rule from, I think, 1981 points out that there's an ambiguity in our existing evidentiary rule, and points out that the word representative of a client still is not precisely defined. It says it's unclear how Oregon courts will define representative of a client, and then cites two rule of evidence two cases that existed before we had the existing statute that said that the privilege did apply to any form of agency. So what we have, of course, taken the tack of saying is that the legislative commentary to the existing rule would protect our communications with specified agents, even though the rule expressly does not do that, because these people are not employees, they're not principals, they're not officers, and they're not directors. In litigation, we use a number of devices to protect that. One, we assert that the word employee can be interpreted to mean independent contractors, and look to the legislative commentary. Two, we use litigation committees. I've had the privilege of representing Homeowners Association recently, I guess not so recently, representing the Mountain High Homeowners Association in Deschutes County, where Representative Wisnett is fighting to retain their golf course, and Representative Stiegler, so yeah. You may know about that case.
Just a little.
Just a little bit, okay. And we were successful in obtaining restoration of the golf course that was destroyed, but that was very typical. We needed a litigation committee for communication. They didn't use a managing agent, and the board, which are all volunteers, are very up on their toes, but we needed to use other devices to protect the confidential communications. I also encountered personal injury cases. I recently settled a very important, significant head injury case representing a woman who was brain damaged, but many of my communications occurred with her husband. He was there when I was hired by the woman, and therefore, I want to say, virtually every important meeting I've had in the case. Under our rule, you could say those communications are not privileged. But the only way to really communicate with my client, the injured spouse, was really through her husband, who was not, you know, as far as I was concerned, he was a representative of my client, and I was fortunate that in the course of the case, I was never really asked. Opposing counsel did not have the temerity to demand that all communications that occurred with the husband be disclosed, because it didn't fall strictly within the scope of privilege. I think it goes without saying that there are people in litigation who ought to fall within the privilege, because they're essential to the communication of legal advice that, strictly speaking, don't come within the rule. When Representative Barton, I guess, first proposed the bill, I, of course, as a member of OTLA, saw that there was a lot of objection, because the word agents removing the word employee and substituting the word agent was really too broad. There are all sorts of agents that are hired that really are not there for the purpose of legal advice, and worked with members of OTLA to craft a change and learn, of course, if we all relearn history, that there is a Uniform Act. In fact, the Uniform Rules of Evidence Act has a provision that specifically would solve this problem and be consistent with the privilege existing in other states. Now, there does remain, Representative Barton, as I was sitting in the back, a difference between the Dash 2 amendment and what is in the Uniform Rule, which I'd like to address for a minute, because I think that solves some of the ambiguity that's been discussed about the extent to which independent contractors are affected. And by the way, I did want to, maybe before doing that, address the question from the chair about how this would affect things in the criminal context. And this really would, as far as I'm concerned, be no different, would provide no broader privilege in a criminal context than what currently is asserted. Right now, the privilege applies to employees, correct? Now, in my view, that is really overbroad, that every employee in an organization is entitled to a privilege. I'll go to a deposition in a civil case to take the deposition of someone who's a fact witness or a records keeper, or someone who's not an officer or director, and I'll find my opposing counsel claiming that that employee, that person, is their client. So I don't do criminal law, but I imagine if that's how the rule is applied in civil contexts, corporations could assert the same privilege in a criminal context. So I'm not sure how that would work, because I don't practice there. But there is an ambiguity in the Dash 2 Amendment, and a difference between the Dash 2 Amendment and the Uniform Act that I would like to point out. And I refer to it as the kind of stranded provision on line 5, if you will. The Dash 2 Amendment reads that the representative of a client means, in Part B, a person who has authority to obtain professional legal services on behalf of the client, comma, or to act on the legal advice rendered to the client, semicolon, or, and then we go to the C part. Now, the Uniform Act reads a little differently, and I think this is something that that maybe should be corrected, because otherwise you're going to strand the second part on line 5. And I don't think that's intended by the committee by the comments I've heard, which would mean that the representative of the client means a person, dot, 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 who has authority to act on legal advice rendered to the client. I think that's too broad, because I think lots of people in a company have authority to act on legal advice that ought not come within the privilege. So I want to refer us back to the Uniform Act, which adds something that really tightens that up. And here's what the Uniform Act reads, if I can read it aloud. Quote, representative of a client means a person having authority to obtain professional legal services, comma, or to act on legal advice rendered, comma, and here's the addition, on behalf of the client or a person who, comma, for the purpose of effectuating legal representation for the client, comma, makes or receives a confidential communication while acting in the scope of employment for the client. Now, by adding that other phrase, a person who has authority to act on legal advice rendered, comma, on behalf of the client or a person, really tightens that up. That means that you are specifically hired to act on that legal advice on behalf of that client. And I think that does a much better job of narrowing the ambiguity that I think came out in your question. So in order to do that, a change would need to be made. And if I could just read what I think would need to be done to the Dash 2 Amendment to make it identical to the Uniform Act, that would be on line 5, to delete the semicolon and the word or, to add a comma after the word client, followed by the phrase on behalf of the client, to put a comma there, then to delete on line 6 the reference to C and the reference to a person who. So what we would have as a conclusion is representative of a client means a principal, an officer, or director of the client. No problem there. That makes sense. Or B, a person who has authority to obtain professional services on behalf of the client or to act on legal advice rendered, comma, on behalf of the client or a person who, comma, for the purpose of effectuating legal representation of the client, comma, makes or receives a confidential communication while acting in the scope of employment for the client. I think that is exactly what the Uniform Act provides and would stop what I consider to be both inadequate scope of the attorney-client privilege and too broad scope for the attorney-client privilege that exists now. And with that, I'm happy to answer any questions you have. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say I have no trouble with that amendment.
Okay. Representative Smith?
And my question is what you recited that I caught, but maybe not exactly, was that your recitation of what the Uniform Act exactly says, or is it your best interpretation of, delineation of its best intent? And if it is A, you know, or is, are the dash two amendments the perfect manifestation of the Uniform Act? Sort of, you know, which is it? I think you already said, but I just want to be really clear on which is it.
Thank you for your question, Representative Smith. What I read is, with one grammatical correction,
yep,
exactly what the Uniform Act provides.
Okay. Thank you.
So just to be really clear, what you're recommending is that we essentially make amendments to be in concert with what the Uniform Act currently reads.
And that's correct. I think that is the intent of the change, and certainly after my discussions with my colleagues at the Oregon Trial Lawyers, I think that is what swung them to at least not oppose the bill, and because the former language to agents was really too broad. And I'm confident that Mr. Neuberger, with whom I've been communicating from their legislative committee, would not be in opposition to an amendment that is strictly like the Uniform Act. And I know Kristen Leonard's sitting behind me, so she'll hit me if I'm incorrect.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Meyer.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. I really ended up thinking I shouldn't be here. I had intended to make my comments to the original bill, which was all I understood to be up for discussion today. So, quite frankly, as to the Dash 2 amendments, I think I should simply say that OCDLA has no position with respect to the Dash 2s.
Okay, I just will ask again, how would this affect a criminal case? I mean, what I don't want to see is some pimp making his sporting lady his client and getting privileged somehow, something like that.
I think the Dash 2s, if you want me to address my comments,
please,
probably to the Dash 2s, as I read it, it really is limited to those corporate defendants, or to, if it were an individual defendant, it would be one engaged in a profession or a business enterprise, because otherwise you really wouldn't have persons acting on their behalf who had authority to obtain professional legal advice or to act upon legal advice. I don't see this being stretched that far in response to the chair's comments. Really, the way in criminal law we see this happening is with environmental prosecutions. Very frequently, your corporations, who would be your client, your corporate client, does outsource as an independent contractor and environmental compliance consultants. And it's really necessary to be able to confer, get their feedback, have them act on your advice. And so that's really where we wanted to pick up with respect to the original bill.
Thank you. Questions? Okay, thank you very much. Oh, wait, sorry, Mr. Taylor.
Mr. Chairman of the committee. Mr. Uglow, when we have the term the person's employment with the client, what does the Uniform Act mean as it relates to that term?
The Uniform Act, counsel, thank you for your question. The Uniform Act does not define the representative of the client with respect to the word employment or employed. But certainly I believe that the existing language in the Uniform Act, which means a person having authority to obtain legal advice or to act on that advice on behalf of the client or a person, and so on, as I read into the record, would most definitely include certain employees whose task it is to obtain legal advice or to act on legal advice on behalf of that client. Not every employee has that limited purpose. They're just there to be an employee. And the Uniform Act, I think, narrows the scope of employees to say, are you the kind of employee who is there to act on legal advice on behalf of the client, on behalf of that person? And I think that, so it would include employees, but a narrower group of employees than I, at least I find now in my civil practice who claim to be within the privilege.
Yes. Steve, one further question. Would that also include someone who we would consider now an agent?
I believe the Uniform Act would include certain agents as well. And again, the agency would have to be limited to those persons who have been hired specifically to obtain legal services, such as what Mr. Bennett talked about, or to act on legal advice, such as these community managing agents. They are independent contractors who their job is to really facilitate legal services often on a day-to-day basis in collection. They're the ones interacting with the paralegals and lawyers in our office on collecting homeowners' dues, not the board of directors of these nonprofit organizations.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Representative Shields has a question.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Can I ask one more question? So I'm curious how this might play out in kind of the rough and tumble of landlord-tenant issues. Would this, if you had a management agency that was hired to, you know, manage the day-to-day operations of an apartment complex and they acted unlawfully, would that would any communication between them and the corporate owner then be privileged communication?
Well, I think certain communications could be. I think, again, you have to look at what they're doing, what that property management company is doing. I would think that, do they have authority to obtain legal advice? If it's within the scope of that property management company's job to obtain counsel, then I think those communications would be privileged. In fact, I haven't done any landlord-tenant work in a long time, but had to appear in certain FED actions and often would see management companies there appearing for FEDs. They weren't lawyers. They were there on behalf of the landlord. And I would suspect that the owner of those properties, if you know the management company communicating with the owner to have a lawyer do an FED, I think would expect that communication to be privileged. But I don't think ordinary business acts, communications with tenants, bookkeeping, information about the condition of the premises, things that are just business activities done by a managing agent are privileged. I think the rule in the Uniform Act talks about whether this is done, quote, for the purpose of effectuating legal representation for the client. And not all acts of a management company, even the ones we deal with, or independent contractors or agents or employees, are done for, quote, the purpose of effectuating legal representation. But if it is, I would suggest to you that those communications ought to be protected.
One quick follow-up. What has me concerned is the second part of that that sentence, or to act on legal advice rendered to the client. It would certainly seem to me that the management companies are getting legal advice constantly on how to proceed on, I mean, even if it's just getting tenants to sign a contract. So under that portion of it, almost every management company would be covered, don't you think?
Well, I think I think that's correct to the extent that if the management company is contacting an attorney on behalf of the owner to get legal advice about what ought to be in a rental agreement, for example, I would suggest to you that the owner of that property would expect that communication to be privileged. If that is the purpose of having that property manager, I would suggest to you that the owner of that building, apartment, if that, I mean, that's why that person's managing that building. If that person's also charged with the task of communicating with the lawyer about a landlord-tenant issue, I would think the owner expects that communication with the property manager to be privileged. And I think it's addressed in the Uniform Act by limiting it to the phrase, the communication has to be, quote, for the purpose of effectuating legal representation for the client, end quote. So it has to be for that purpose, not for every purpose in the world that is business-related.
Right. So finally, wouldn't it make sense then if we wanted to get it in line with the Uniform Code to take out that second part of subsection B that says, or to act on legal advice rendered to the client?
Well, I think that the addition that I read into the record, frankly, Representative Shields, I think with that addition, it does a better job than just deleting it, because it connects the B part and the existing C part okay. in a way that you have a modifying phrase that I think solves the problem.
Okay, good. Well, thank you. I appreciate it. I look forward to seeing that amendment. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2453, and we'll reset that for the 13th and see if we can't come up with an amendment by then. Next, open a public hearing on House Bill 2498. Okay, Mr. Fiskum, Annette Price, and Chief Klon, and Joel Buchanan as well, if you want to drag a chair up.
House Bill 2498 creates a crime of endangering an aircraft in the second degree, expands the Port of Portland's policing authority to all property owned, operated, maintained, or controlled by the Port of Portland. We do not yet have the fiscal impact statement on this.
Thank you.
Chair, good afternoon, committee members. For the record, Dave Fiskum here for the Port of Portland. Annette Price's name was on the schedule in case she got back up from a Ways and Means obligation she has, and she hasn't, so it's me. We're here to support House Bill 2498. With me to my right are Chief Phil Klon, the Chief of the Port of Portland Police. Officer Joel Buchanan is to farther on my right, and then you'll be happy to know that Mr. Buchanan brought Rocky with him today, and no doubt Rocky will be the most cogent of the testifiers before you in the next moments. This is the third time we've been before a legislative session with this piece of legislation relative to port security issues. I hope this is ready for your favorable consideration, but Mr. Chair, committee members will be pleased to both provide some testimony about the rationale for this bill coming before you, as well as be prepared to answer any of your questions. I know some of you weren't here in previous sessions, and so this is the first time through for you, and we'll be pleased to answer any questions. For the record, I have submitted a letter from the Port of Portland, as well as a letter from the Oregon Association of Chiefs of Police. Kevin Campbell was unable to stay and wanted me to submit that for the record, so I have done that. With that, Mr. Chair, and with your indulgence, I'd like to turn to the Chief to make the comments on the bill that he chooses to make, and we'll be pleased again in the end to answer your questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Thank you for your time this afternoon. I am Phil Klon. I'm the Chief of Police with the Port of Portland. Have been that way. I'm working on my eighth year out at the airport and for the Port of Portland. We consider this a public safety bill and a port security bill. House Bill 2498 includes three changes to ORS. It revises language in ORS 778.260 to better reflect the needs of the port in protecting its facilities and its operations. Secondly, it includes the port police in definitions of police officer and enforcement officer in the ORS, the part of the ORS that has to do with vehicle enforcement. And finally, it amends ORS 164885, endangering aircraft, to include a endangering aircraft in the second degree, a misdemeanor charge for the possession of firearm firearms or dangerous weapons, dangerous or deadly weapons in the restricted areas of a commercial service airport, the non-public restricted areas of an airport. A little bit about the Port of Portland. We have 53 sworn officers, all who go through the State Academy, through the state certification process. We are the primary emergency responders for the airport, the Portland International Airport. Crimes. We provide proactive enforcement of vehicle codes. We provide patrol both inside and outside of the airport facility. In addition to our traditional law enforcement services, Port police officers respond to and investigate all airport security violations in accordance with federal aviation regulations. We ensure compliance with all of the Transportation Security Administration aviation security directives and requirements that relate to law enforcement. One of those key regulations is 49 CFR 1542. This requires each airport operator, and for PDX, that's the Port of Portland, each airport operator must supply law enforcement personnel in number and manner adequate to support its security program, and that these law enforcement personnel meet the following qualifications. They must have authority to arrest under the criminal laws of the state and local jurisdictions in which the airport is located. They are identified by some kind of sign of authority, which is our uniform and badge, that they're armed and with a firearm and authorized to use it, and that they meet the training standards for law enforcement officers in the state. There are federal criminal codes that apply to the airports. Those are generally under the jurisdiction of the FBI, and those apply to crimes such as air piracy, also known as hijacking, terrorism, and other major violent crimes. There are also federal civil regulations and statutes that govern possession of firearms and weapons in the restricted areas of an airport. Those generally have civil aviation penalties, which can be applied by the TSA or the Transportation Security Administration after the fact. Our responsibility is to respond initially and make a determination, is there an appropriate charge? In looking at the endangering aircraft piece of this, we found that most states, including California and Washington, have enacted airport-specific laws to enable law enforcement at airports to take enforcement action that's aligned with those federal civil aviation rules. And that's what we're part of what we're asking for here with this amendment to the endangering aircraft piece. We all know that the terrorism attacks at September 11th, 2001 changed dramatically aviation. Subsequent terrorist incidents and related intelligence have led to sweeping changes not only at the airport, but in other transportation modes, including on the marine terminals. And those are gradually coming under the same level of federal regulatory oversight as the aviation industry. Marine security has its own set of federal regulations, including the need for a site-specific facility security program under the regulatory oversight of the U.S. Coast Guard. Internally, the Port of Portland has realigned its security organization to encompass all departments, part of the One Port concept developed by Executive Director Bill Wyatt. Public safety, aviation security, marine security, emergency management, and by the way, public safety includes police and fire. All those have been consolidated under one manager for the port to facilitate cooperation and communication in securing the port's facilities and assets. In the past 4 years, the Port Police, while maintaining its primary mission of aviation policing, has also supported the marine terminals and the security personnel there with special operations and also through training, investigations, and intelligence sharing. I'll let Officer Buchanan talk a little bit about what he's done out at the marine terminals in a few minutes here. It is also very foreseeable that the Port of Portland may be required by the federal government or may choose for operational purposes to assign port police officers to non-aviation operations such as the marine terminals, similar to what's done at the Port of Seattle and other standalone port authorities throughout the country. We are obviously not alone in our efforts. We have very good working relationships with mutual aid partners, to include the Portland Police Bureau, Multnomah County, and various local and state federal agencies. We also are involved in the local FBI Joint Terrorism Task Force, the U.S. Attorney's Anti-Terrorism Advisory Council, and numerous aviation-related and general intelligence groups. Now, back to House Bill 2498. As I said in the beginning, House Bill 2498 amends ORS 778.260, which is the section that deals with the Port of Portland's ability to appoint peace officers. The changes align the legislative language with the overall mission of the Port of Portland, and it positions the Port of Portland to move very quickly to address changes in security requirements for any and all of its operations, not just the airport. It also clarifies language in Section 2 of 778.260 by eliminating language, quote, at airports owned, operated, maintained, and controlled by the port, unquote, and it inserts language that reflects that the Port Police have the same statewide authority granted all Oregon law enforcement officers. As I mentioned, there are two minor changes in the vehicle code, inclusion of the definitions of police officer and enforcement officer. Finally, just a little bit more about the endangering aircraft. It amends ORS 164.885, endangering aircraft, to include a misdemeanor crime of endangering aircraft in the second degree.
Specific to possession of a
firearm or dangerous or deadly weapon in restricted areas of a commercial service airport, linked to the Federal Civil Aviation Code, with a reference to the airport security program, which every commercial airport must have under federal regulation. In support of the officers in our role as first responders and the primary peacekeepers at Portland International Airport, this language enables port officers to arrest, detain, and criminally charge individuals who are unlawfully armed in the areas that offer direct access to airplanes, whether that be the sterile areas where people board the gates or what we call the secured area, which is the area where the employees are who are servicing and working on the airplanes. Those restricted areas are direct access areas to airports and at most at risk. These incidents, though infrequent, are often of national significance. And although they may lead eventually to federal criminal charges, it's generally only after local law enforcement has taken some immediate action using their authority under state and local law. The mission of the Port of Portland is to provide competitive cargo and passenger access to regional, national, and international markets while enhancing the region's quality of life. In pursuit of this mission, the Port of Portland has many facilities and operations that must be safeguarded to ensure a vibrant economy for Oregon. House Bill 2498 preserves the port's rights to use all of its resources to accomplish its mission and to protect all of the assets of the Port of Portland. Thank you, I'll go ahead and let Officer Buchanan testify, and we'll certainly be happy to answer any questions.
Officer Buchanan. Please,
Chair, members of the committee. Excuse my voice.
Please identify yourself for the record. Thank you.
I'm Officer Joel Buchanan, and this is my canine partner, Rocky. He's a 9-year-old Dutch Shepherd, if you're curious, and he's one of four canines in the Port of Portland Explosive Detection Canine Unit. I've been a canine handler for 11 years, and I've worked with Rocky for the last 7 years. I'm a 14-year veteran of the Port of Portland Police Department, and over these 14 years, I've seen this department and the Portland Airport grow and evolve to meet the growing needs of the public.
Cameras.
Amen. 9/11 caused our department to double in size. We had to do mass hirings during the post 9/11 years. Because of a reasonably safe work environment and a very competitive wage, we were able to high quality lateral transferring police officers from around the state. From these transfers, we obtained some of the brightest veteran officers, sergeants, and lieutenants from the Portland Police Bureau and other surrounding agencies. Our instructors for firearms, defensive tactics, and training of newly hired officers are second to none and have years of experience. This laid the foundation for what I believe is one of the most highly trained and competent police departments in the state. We are very progressive and are able to handle the ever-changing demands of a rapidly growing airport and community. In our canine unit, this is also true. We have gone from 2 canines in the early 90s to 4 canines now and possibly a 5th canine in the future. Our canine units are in high demand across Oregon and Southwest Washington because of there are only a few explosive canine detection teams in the state due to the high cost of maintaining such a unit. Our primary focus is the protection of the tenants and traveling public at the airport. However, as part of the Metropolitan Explosive Detection Unit, our canines are used in such situations as bomb threats at schools, protection of the VIPs coming into town, such as the president, participation at the last summer Olympic trials in Eugene, and most recently the Woodburn bank bombing. On top of assisting outside agencies, TSA has also tasked our unit with screening cargo going in on domestic flights along with random checks of carry-on luggage passing through the checkpoints in the terminal. In the last year, we have branched out to doing monthly random sweeps of cargo at Terminal 6 and 4, which is the port terminals down in the Willamette River. We have done these sweeps in conjunction with the Port of Portland Marine Security and federal law enforcement agencies such as U.S. Customs. In my opinion, we are scratching the surface of incoming and outgoing cargo that could contain weapons of mass destruction. In these post-9/11 days, I feel we need an increased presence at all Port of Portland properties because these properties have a direct impact of what enters and exits this state, whether it be by boat or aircraft or rail. As it stands right now, the Portland Airport is the only port property that has constant law enforcement presence. In conclusion, I would like to thank you for your time, and I hope I have been informative enough to make you for you to make a positive decision concerning the future of our department.
Thank you. And Chief, I want to just note for the committee, I met with you during the interim, and the endangering the aircraft is if somebody drives a service truck or something back in where the airplanes are, they don't want any firearms back in there because even if that person didn't have bad intent, somebody else could see it, put it on the airplane, and so on. And they ask that that be an A misdemeanor with great concern over the cost of making it a felony. They would have made more sense to make it a felony, but they took that into consideration in asking for this law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's correct.
Yeah. Nothing else? Okay, thank you then. Representative Smith, I've got questions.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thanks for bringing Rocky. There is almost nothing more inspiring in the human experience than, you know, work dogs, safety dogs, and guide dogs. I mean, if Rocky could run for office, Rocky would beat anybody on this panel. Rocky would be me. I'm not sure to whom to direct the question, maybe to you, Chief. What impact, if any, would this have on general aviation, like small planes, folks parked at flight craft? Related question, have we interfaced with, like, the Aviation Caucus in this building, and or I assume we've talked to the Pilots Association and the State Aviation Board, but particularly some of the folks who are concerned about general aviation who are organized around now? It's a long bill. Any information you can provide would be helpful.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Smith. We're not targeting specifically the general aviation airports. For the Port of Portland, there are two reliever airports. That would be Hillsborough and Troutdale. At this point in time, there is no requirement to have law enforcement, there's not the same kind of requirement as there is at the Portland International Airport, which is a commercial airport. In the past, our involvement has been mostly for special events and some internal investigations or special investigations. And at Hillsborough, obviously, we work very carefully with the Hillsborough Police because they are the primary responders. If something should happen of an immediate emergency nature, they're going to respond to the Hillsborough Airport. And similarly, out in Troutdale, we are not the primary responders. Troutdale is. There is legislation right now, which is called the Large Aircraft Security Program, or LASP, which TSA is working through with the airline industry and the aviation industry. That has not been adopted yet in its final form. There is a piece of that speaks to law enforcement support, similar to commercial aviation airports.
Whether that's going to continue is a big question mark, because it could be very expensive for general aviation airports, and that's up in the air. So this language here probably has immediately has probably very little effect on general aviation, because the federal regulations just aren't there at this time.
Thanks very much. And one follow-up point, Mr. Chair. To the extent, as you guys are moving forward, interfacing with, I mean, there's a few folks on it, but Senator Betsy Johnson, Representative Vicky Berger, there are a few people that are sort of an aviation caucus, to the extent that we can, you know, interface with them, and they can be a proxy for the rest of us who are trying to get up to speed on aviation policy, law, and practice, would be helpful. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm done.
Thank you. Representative Krieger.
Yeah, just a few questions and comments so we can get up to clarify. There's four members of the committee that weren't here before, and this bill basically has been here, what is it, three times or
this
four?
This is our third session.
Third time.
Yes.
And I were there. And in fact, I think the bill's maybe improved a little bit. You've included a few things that you've needed, and I think I can go along with those. But I want to make a record of a couple things so that everybody feels comfortable that was here before. You'll have a Dash 1 amendment that probably we'll talked about in a few minutes. But I want to ask a couple questions. How do you answer them? Talk about what Dexter Johnson said about the Dash 1 amendments. Have the illegal ordinances regarding the posting of firearms prohibition at Port of Portland been rescinded and removed from the books? In other words, you're taking the signs down, but are they still part of policy in any way?
Can you address that? Mr. Chair and Representative Krieger, with a rewrite of the ordinance that occurred this last summer, there is no longer a firearms reference in the ordinance. That has been addressed.
Okay, and the other thing is, in Section 2, in the back, where it talks about the adopt, amend, repeal sections that have given us a little bit of concern, that's lines 3, 4, 5, in your reading of that, is there any way that the Port of Portland, you think, has authority to establish restricted areas that are not designated by TSA in which firearms would be prohibited?
No, I don't think there's any intent with those changes, adopt, amend, or repeal, to give the port the ability that would be contrary to 166, I believe it's 170.
Yeah.
Yes, 166-170, yeah. Representative Krieger.
Okay, thank you very much. The other thing is, we asked for the Dash 1 amendments, which we'll try to get in here in a minute when we get some other testimony and the chair is ready. But there was a letter from Dexter Johnson. I want to read it. It's pretty short. It says, enclose the amendment to House Bill 2497, which clarifies that the Port of Portland may not adopt regulations relating to firearms. We believe that ORS 166.170 states in unequivocal terms that the regulation of firearms is vested solely in the Legislative Assembly. Thus, while the amendment requested does not change or contradict current law, neither is it necessary to prevent the Board from adopting regulations relating to firearms. The concern is that placing this statement of ORS 778-260, but not in other statute where it might also be placed as a reminder, could lead future courts to conclude that the Legislative Assembly intended prohibition to apply only here in this particular statute. Now, if you recall, Chief Dominguez, Chief Brewer came in, and at the beginning of each session, they introduce and inform this committee about legislative intent. So this is to establish legislative intent here. If the bill passes, I will do so on the floor again. If you read what Dexter said, and I'm saying it to the people in black robes that might try to interpret something at a later date, it is our intent that this applies everywhere, and it doesn't have a stronger place here, but because of the past practices of the Port of Portland Board over the last 6 years, we want it in the statute as giving you the privileges that you want, and we want to make sure that the court understands that it doesn't diminish in any way the strength of the what was intended by the legislative assemblies, stating specifically that it is unequivocally the regulation of firearms are vested solely in the Legislative Assembly.
Mr. Chair, just a couple quick things. I think I would say, just as a general comment, that the Port of Portland's intent is to live within state and federal law, and we contend with both. The chief is the best expert on what he does in both those regards relative to public safety. And I know the amendment that Representative Krieger referred to, the Dash 1 amendment, is not necessarily before you yet, but when it is, we would appreciate a chance to comment on it, and we can do that after it's presented, if you like, Mr. Chair.
You could go ahead and comment on it now if you want to.
Well, I guess I would say, on behalf of the Port of Portland, two or three things. One, we hadn't seen this amendment until the start of your hearing. One of the reasons I left the witness chair a moment ago was to continue something we've been trying to do for the last hour or so, which is consult with our council in Portland by phone relative to this language. At first blush, and I'm going to say this very intentionally, it seems acceptable to us, perhaps not identical to the words in ORS 166170, but close to those words. It seems to me that you would have, at your discretion, Mr. Chair and committee members, two options, at least, if you want to consider this amendment. One is to accept our words on the record in terms of what our intent is on behalf of the Port of Portland relative to living within the confines of state and federal law. Or, secondly, for the record statement by me, if our council in Portland, who hasn't seen this in print yet, has heard about it by phone, as a question, with your indulgence, Mr. Chair, we would propose to consider a change if we thought one was necessary on the Senate side rather than stall this bill now, because this bill is very important to us, a very clear top Port of Portland priority in this legislative session. If that's not acceptable, the other option, Mr. Chair, would be to give us a day and let us check the words more specifically. Again, I don't mean to imply that's a big hurdle. We just have a council in Portland who would like to look at these words one more time. We've been trying to do an email phone kind of routine with her. I think that's what I'd say. I don't think we would bridle at the words as we understand them to be, but just have this one further check to make. And if we can do that in the Senate side, that may be the best option if you would not be comfortable accepting our statements for the record.
Thank you. We're not going to be able to move the bill today. We don't have the fiscals back, so
okay.
Okay, we'll be working on that. Okay, any questions for this panel? Thank you very much. Mr. Harder and Mr. Sterrett, please. I'll grab this copy. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Rod Harder, the working consultant for the National Rifle Association of America. Be very brief today. We worked with Representative Krieger to bring the amendment forward for the main particular reason. This is, as they said, the third time we've seen this bill. And the prior two sessions, we objected because Port of Portland had a bill that prohibited carry of concealed handguns and other firearms in the airport terminal. That was put into place by the Port of Portland in violation of existing statute. We told them at the time that if they would obey the law, we would take away or we would remove our objection. They chose not to do that. They stated very clearly that they had the authority to do that, to put that into effect, and they quoted the portions of the law that are being amended today. This amendment makes it very clear, makes it crystal clear that they can no longer do that. It is in the law currently. If I were very sure they would obey the law, we would not have any objection, and moving forward from there, we have no opposition to the rest of the bill. We think it's a good bill, provided we have those that security given us. Mr. Hardy, you heard today the Port of Portland representative saying they clearly understand that and they're not going to violate that. Do you still think we need the Dash 1s?
Mr. Chair, I'm going to defer to Representative Krieger on that. I work with and for him on this particular amendment.
Okay. Mr. Sterrett.
For the record, Kevin Starrett, Oregon Firearms Federation. We're here in support of the Dash 1 amendments. Several years ago, for the folks who haven't been on this committee in the past, as Mr. Harder pointed out, we had objected to similar legislation because of the violation of the law on the part of the Port of Portland. And a very long story to make it short, it started when I contacted the port asking where they thought they got the authority to restrict license holders, and I received a phone call from their attorney telling me she was giving my name to the Department of Homeland Security. I then received a letter from the chief advising me to tell my constituents that if they came to the port, they would be arrested, and if they were found in possession of a firearm. Because of the lengthy back and forth with the port authorities, I feel more comfortable having something in statute. The fact is the port has changed their ordinance based largely in part because of all the work that some members of this committee did to convince them that they were violating the law. And since in the past they seemed to be pretty comfortable doing that, unless, and as Representative Krieger pointed out, unless it becomes negative to what we're trying to get to, meaning it could open up other problems, we would like to see it expressly stated that this is in fact what your desires are.
Okay, thank you. I just had some concerns over the letter, the way that explained it, but I think we can overcome that. But any further questions? Thank you very much. In order to give the port attorney a chance to take a look at that so we don't have to do amendment after amendment, I'm going to close the public, and because we're not ready to move the bill.
Mr. Chair, I want to be really crystal clear that what we don't do by insert, if interpretation of existing law is such that this is taken into consideration, I don't want to put us in a position where we're going to be opening a can of worms, legislative intent or not. I've been down that road in courts, and I know how complicated it can get. I don't want to open the, you know, I want to be really clear that we're not going to be jeopardizing something in the future by trying to do something here that we think needs to be done for some purpose that I personally don't feel is an issue or problem, if that's been made pretty crystal clear. So,
and thank you. And just to point out, the part of the problem was this took a while to get it accomplished, to get the port to agree to that.
And I understand that. Yeah, and there are other routes to go to get that taken care of, and without jeopardizing potentially other aspects of the application of the law. And I just think it may be too broad and overreaching, and it may put us in.
Well, we'll take a close look at that, and we'll have a little bit of time to do that while we're waiting for the fiscal. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2498.
Mr. Chair, and as long as we're between hearings, I just wanted to mention that it is the birthday of our favorite committee counsel today, who just turned 23.
Bill Taylor? Bill Taylor, yeah.
Happy birthday. I didn't realize he was in the room. Otherwise, I wouldn't refer to Shannon as our favorite.
Very diplomatic. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Barton. Open a work session on House Bill 2393.
Mr.
Taylor
wants an invitation to come back.
Oh, I see. Okay. Mr. Taylor. Sorry, Mr. Taylor. Now that Shannon's out of the room, I just want to say you're my favorite committee counsel.
Chair, members of the committee, it's nice to know that I'm at least someone's favorite. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2393 comes to you from the Oregon Sheriff's Association. It increases certain fees that sheriffs charge for delivery of service and garnishments. It also will establish a WebNet page where they can list legal process and papers that they file, such as attachments. You have the Dash 2 and Dash 3 amendments in front of you. The Dash 2 sets the increase for service of summons and other legal documents at $36 rather than $40, sets the fee for delivery of a writ of garnishment at $25, clarifies that a person other than the sheriff can deliver a writ of garnishment. The Dash 3 require all sheriffs to enter into an intergovernmental agreement to establish a website for the posting of legal notices. You may remember the last time this bill was up, we had a discussion about the concern about having some sheriffs do it and not all sheriffs doing it, and therefore the difficulty in relying upon the web page. Currently, under law, the Oregon courts have this responsibility if funded, and they've never been funded to do it. So,
okay, we have
the Dash 3. I believe we also have fiscal impact statements for both the Dash 2 and the Dash 3.
I just have Dash 2s, it says.
They were just passed out at the beginning of the meeting, I believe.
I've got two number 2s.
Let me read them to you. How's that, Mr. Chair, members of the committee? Let me go on page 3, line 2 of your bill. After the period, delete the rest of the line.
We've got both of those. The fiscal impact.
We have fiscal, Mr. Chairman of the committee, we have the fiscal. We should have the fiscal on both the Dash 2 and the Dash 3s. The Dash 3s are very short. I can read them. After the period, delete the rest of the line and delete lines 3 through 6. So basically reduce lines 3 through 6 and insert a website where legal notices are under ORS 18860-18993 may be posted shall be established if all sheriffs in the state enter into an intergovernmental agreement under ORS Chapter 190 for the purposes of establishing and maintaining the website.
Mr. Chair, I have both the amendments, but I have two copies of a fiscal on just Dash 2.
Chair, members of the committee, I have the Dash 3 fiscal in front of me. I thought it was passed out, at least I asked it to be passed out. And this, it basically says this bill does not affect local government service levels or shared revenue sufficient to trigger Section 15, Article 9. This bill will raise the fees collected by sheriffs for serving legal documents, allows two or more sheriffs to enter an intergovernmental agreement to post specific information on a website, provides procedures for the challenge of a writ of garnishment, provides procedures. It just gives an analysis. It does not indicate that there is any fiscal impact.
Okay.
And this bill, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, does go to Revenue Committee from here.
Okay, do we?
Mr. Chair, so I don't have the Dash 3s in front of me. I don't have the fiscal in front of me. Do we have extra copies of those somewhere, or are we run short?
Mr. Chair, we will get you copies.
And do we have a speaker's
list? 3s. So, yeah. 2s I've got.
That's what you're saying.
We have a list of.
This is I
just generally, but I need the Dash 3 and then the fiscal.
Nobody's got the 3s.
I've got the Dash 3 amendment. I've just got, I don't have the Dash 3 fiscals. Do you have the Dash 3 amendment?
I haven't had anything all day.
Welcome to my world, Representative.
There's the Dash 2. I got an extra one. But I don't have any Dash 3s either.
Ask a couple clarifying questions.
Representative Shields.
On the fiscal analysis, Mr. Taylor, on the Dash 2s, I assume it'll probably say the same thing for the Dash 3s. The last paragraph, the bill will have a sizable revenue impact on county sheriffs and may have an impact on the district attorneys. Do you have any idea what that's all
members of the committee, I do not know. I could see where it have a positive revenue impact for sheriffs.
I'm just curious about how the district attorneys fit into this bill.
I'm not sure either, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Shields, but the bill does have a prior referral to the revenue committee.
I'll move it if it's the chair's intent.
Well,
that's fine.
Okay,
but I just might have some questions if it gets to the floor.
Yeah, come on up there and just talk about while we're getting the paperwork, if it's been resolved, if the amendments have been resolved, if there's still a problem.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jim Markey on behalf of the Oregon Collectors Association, the Dash 2s are ours. The original bill created an inadvertent problem for creditors by deleting lines 40 through 42 on page 2 and inserting writ of garnishment under ORS 21410, in which a creditor would not have been able to recover certain costs of a writ of garnishment. It's a technical issue. The dash 2s restore the original language with respect to those things. The sheriffs have no problem with that. And then we made two changes in fees, which I think we've all agreed that we would like to see the amendments adopted, move the bill forward to revenue, and we may continue discussions about fees, but that could be done over there.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing Oregon's 36 county sheriffs. The amendment, as Mr. Markey had pointed out, with the fees and the section dealing with garnishments, we would like the bill to move forward. We are still negotiating on the fees, and you, while you'll lose jurisdiction over that fight, you will know which one of us was successful, because the deal we've offered is that we won't be back with these specific fees next session if he'll give us what we want, and otherwise we'll just be back here in 2 years. And it's my understanding that the fiscal issue that Representative Shields raised, Mr. Chair, deals with child support issues, in which there would be a delivery paid for in those cases. However, one should realize that those are very heavily subsidized by the federal government. So it's not a huge issue.
Okay, thank you. Thank you. All right. Thanks. Thank you very much. With that, we'll go ahead. What I would like to do is have a motion to move House Bill 2393. Okay. I'm sorry. Two and three. Okay. Open. Well, the work session is open. I'd accept a motion to adopt the dash twos and dash threes.
Chair, I move that the committee move dash two and dash three into 2393.
Representative Wisnant moves the dash two and three amendments into House Bill 2393. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. I look for a motion to move the bill as amended to revenue.
Mr. Chair, I recommend that HB 2393 with dash 2 and dash 3 be submitted to pass to revenue.
Representative Wisnant moves
to pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2393 as amended to revenue with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative
Martin? Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Seeler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Goes to revenue. Close the work session on House Bill 2393. Open a work session on House Bill 2263. Change lawyers.
We have any doubt in my mind.
We heard 2263 back on the 16th of February. This is the bill that expands the kidnapping statute, so the kidnapping in the first degree includes kidnapping of a person under the age of 12 with the purpose of committing a sex offense. This is the bill that specifically brings it in line with Jessica's law. We have an indeterminate fiscal, and we have a revenue impact that states no revenue.
And this has a subsequent referral to Ways and Means. Yep.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I move the approval of House Bill 2263 to Ways and Means of a due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnant moves House Bill 2263 to Ways and Means with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wizinut?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries. Bill is forwarded to Ways and Means. Close the work session on House Bill 2263. Open a work session on House Bill 2269.
House Bill 2269 with the Dash 1 amendment, I believe, was adopted back on the 19th of February. This modifies the computation of the time within which an extra defendant may be held prior to trial. The Dash 1 amendment modified it from 180 to 90. There's a minimal expenditure and no revenue impact.
Is there any discussion? Accept the motion.
Mr. Chair, I move committee recommend or approve House Bill 2269. Send it to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnack moves House Bill 2269 as amended to the floor to do pass. Discussion. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barker?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wizinut?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye.
Motion carries.
Consent. You want to do consent or you want to?
Would the committee like to put that to the consent calendar?
Yeah.
Is there any problem with that? Okay, that goes to the consent calendar. Next, close the work session, open a work session on House Bill 2173.
House Bill 2173, heard on February 4th, narrowed the class of offenders eligible for relief from the reporting requirement. The Dash 1 amendment, specifically, you'll recall, this is the language that narrowed it to prior conviction involving the same victim. There is no revenue, and we had a no expenditure.
Okay. Yeah, that's right. This was so that somebody that had an ongoing event with the same person wouldn't be charged six times or something. So, okay. Is there any discussion?
We already accepted the Dash 1.
Yes, we have.
Okay.
Actually, I don't recall
that.
Okay.
We requested it back on the 4th of February.
Right. Yeah. We've heard back for work on amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash 1s into House Bill 2173.
President Wisnett moves the Dash 1 amendments into House Bill 2173.
Mr. Chair, do we have an extra copy of the Dash 1s?
I've got one.
And do we have an extra copy of the FISL?
I can give you a copy of mine.
I think I was forgotten in all of the handouts today. So, I would like to see that.
Is there any objection to the Dash 1 amendments? Hearing none, they ordered them adopted. Take a motion for the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2173 is amended Dash 1 be sent to the floor of a due pass recommendation.
President Wisnett moves House Bill 2173 as amended to the floor with a due pass. Is there any discussion? Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
Aye.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stiegler?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wizinut?
Aye.
Chair Barker?
Aye. Motion carries. Does anybody want to particularly carry this? Representative Stiegler, would you carry this bill for us? Representative Stiegler will be the carrier. Close the work session on House Bill 2173-1. Open a work session on House Bill 2331.
2331, you should have a Dash 1 amendment in front of you. This is prevents a person who's previously entered a diversion program from being eligible for diversion on a subsequent offense with the original bill. Now, with the modification, I believe it is 15 years. There's a minimal expenditure and there was no revenue impact.
Okay. The Dash One amendments are the result of a work group trying to come up with an accommodation.
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash Ones into House Bill 2331.
Representative Wisnett moves the Dash Ones into House Bill 2331. Is there any discussion or objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
These aren't different.
Mr. Chair, I move that House Bill 2331 with the Dash Ones be sent to the floor with due pass recommendation.
Representative Wisnett moves House Bill 2331 as amended to the floor with the due pass. Is there any discussion? Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm still a little uncomfortable with this bill, so I just wanted to let you know I'll be voting no.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, I just wanted to say thanks to the folks who were in the work group as we're moving forward on these things. As much as we can be putting folks together to be coming up with moderate solutions, sounds good. So I just wanted to say on the record, I appreciate that.
Okay, thank you, Representative Barton.
Mr. Chair, and I want to echo Representative Smith's sentiments that I appreciate the fact that the work group came together and was able to reach a compromise. I want to express, although I plan to support this bill, some concern in that essentially what we're exchanging one per se rule for another, 10 years to 15. And it's I thought that there was a pretty strong consensus from this committee anyway that we were very concerned about this per se rule being over and under inclusive. And I remember Representative Garrett had an astute point that's about certain prosecutorial discretion, for example, that there are certain kinds of people that we did not want to accommodate with a second opportunity of diversion no matter what. And there were other kinds where we thought that might be appropriate. And that this per se rule, be it 10 or 15 years, will not accommodate that. I find it unfortunate that the group was unable to agree on such an approach, but what we have here in front of us as amended is better than the status quo, so I'm going to support it.
Thank you. Call the roll, please.
Representative Barton?
Aye.
Representative Cameron?
Aye.
Representative Garrett?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Representative Shields?
No.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Vice Chair Stigler?
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair Rucker?
Aye.
Motion passes. Is there anyone would like to carry it in particular? I'll carry it. Okay. Is there any further business coming before the committee today?
Very briefly.
Very briefly.
Typically, we do not pass out the fiscals and revenue statements for everyone. If that's going to become more of an issue, especially since we're going to have multiple work sessions, would it be the committee's? Would the committee like to have copies? Is what I'm asking.
There's nothing on it. That's one thing. But if there is some description that it's indeterminate, for example, I'd like to know why it's indeterminate.
Okay. Thank you. We'll do that.
Okay.
No problem.
Hey, adjourned. Happy birthday.
Yeah.